Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene and beyond. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Tara Binton.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. I'm your host, Tara Minton, and today I am here sitting in my living room, would you believe, with the great Birmingham jazz singer Esther Bennett.
Hello. Or I should say, all right, seeing as we're selling Birmingham at the moment.
Absolutely. So we're here with tea, coffee, and some very Christmassy looking cakes. Having
gluten
a lovely time.
Free.
Gluten free, yeah. So we can feel good about them.
Yeah.
Now, Esther, you've just released a record called My Birmingham.
Well, yeah, that's a single. It's the first track from the album Home Is Where the Art Is.
You're right.
But you have preempted, because we are going to bring, where you got that from is we're going to bring out the track My Birmingham as a single in January. We've done a video to accompany it, and Paul Jolly from 33 said it'd be a nice idea to release one of the tracks as a single. And that is really the first, it was the first one we did, and it is the whole ethos. It's where the ethos of home and all the subsequent stuff and ideas came from.
Yeah. So can you tell me a bit about growing up in Birmingham?
Well, Sparkbrook, Birmingham, Moseley, it's where another catalyst really for that piece was the death of Brian Travers from UB40, who was a wonderful man and an artist. And UB40, most of them, are from exactly the same part of Birmingham as me, Sparkbrook, Moseley. In fact, St Barnabas's Church on Ladypool Road, round the corner, was a youth club where they used to go. And and at the end of Ladypool Road is a reggae record shop, one of them, where they used to go and hang out. That part of Birmingham is very multicultural, and UB40 was a very multicultural band. It described an era and a type of music that came out of Birmingham, but also this whole blend of different people, you know, Iranian, Jamaican, Irish. And when he died, it kind of made me really want to explore all the different types of music that come out of Birmingham. I was also doing a website, and it made me think about the sound that you make and yourself as an artist. And although I've been in London for most of my life, I did get interested in exploring what made my particular character as an artist, you know, and being a bit more introspective about it. During lockdown, everybody got a bit like that. Mm. And then somebody had said, I think it's one of the radio shows, you've got that Birmingham sound. And I thought, oh, okay. And I'd always, up until then, I'd probably thought it's a bit egotistical and narcissistic to analyse yourself too much. But sometimes that becomes really important, and not just about the Birmingham thing, but personal memories and personal relationships. You know, I'm quite private about things like that, but it just seemed the right time to really, really delve and not do it on Facebook, but do it in an album.
It's perfect. And actually, I think for all of us who come to London as foreigners, whether we're from another country or just from another city within the UK, we come to London with a bit of a chip, I guess, like we want to make it, or we want to make a mark, whatever that means for us. And there's a breaking down and a building up and a maturity that some of us are lucky enough to reach in London, when we can look at where we've come from and not see that place as lesser than or returning as a failure.
But
actually it's a part of our identity. It's part of our artistic identity.
That's it.
And to return having grown within London.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about your experience with that in lockdown and returning to your Birmingham?
Well, as I said, I left when I was 18 to come to art college. I was going back quite a lot then and getting into music at the same time. I mean, during my time at art college, I bought a saxophone, and I was always into music, but I bought a saxophone and started studying jazz, and then I started working at 606 and all this sort of thing. But so, you know, there's a whole development in London, which was to do with being a musician and then being a singer, doing some acting, but developing that creative thing. But you're very right in that I left because I'd always been coming to London as a child because my mother's best friend was from Hackney and her daughter was my age. But it was definitely that thing of not finding your fortune money-wise, really, for me. But, you know, it was the place to be.
Mm.
If you're going for the arts, it's that Dick Whittington thing, isn't it? You know, London is like it's something to go to. And I think, like you said, whether you're from this country or from another country, people go to make their fortune.
Yeah.
That fortune can be a spiritual thing or a creative thing, not necessarily money. But for the arts, it just was a no-brainer for me. So I was quite a traitor, really, and I left. And you know, then actually there wasn't so much of a jazz scene. It was before pre-conservatoire days. And so jazz wasn't really the thing. It wasn't as big a deal in Birmingham as it is now. But as I said, it was that thing of during lockdown, exploring yourself. I was doing a new website, and which Dari Adelecci made, and his wife Sarah, you know, he showed me examples of his website. On her, she'd done stories, and I thought that was fantastic, you know. And I told her, I said, I'm going to nick that idea. So I did the Birmingham story, I did the London story, and I did it right. I did the stories really right up until my first debut album in 2004,
mm-hmm.
You know, just that development. But it was totally and utterly necessary to go back to Birmingham. And it wasn't just the that type of music. What I've always been fascinated by in Birmingham is the industrial heritage and history of it,
mm-hmm.
because it was once called the workshop of the world.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, like, you know, you say about Nottingham, that was lace, but it was car factories and metalworks. And my dad worked in Wilmot Breedens, which made car accessories. But the Midlands in particular are very big for that.
Yeah.
And also the gunneries and the jewellery quarter, metals and buttons and things. So But the car factories, you know, most people in Birmingham who were, you know, not civil servants, who worked in car factories, mm-hmm. or Bourneville chocolate factory. But what was fascinating to me, and it was a type of music that I hated when I was in Birmingham, was how heavy metal came out of that.
Oh, yeah.
A bit like Detroit and Motown, you know, sort of honk sounds of the cars. And there's a fascinating documentary by Judas Priest, who I would have hated when I was a teenager. I hated them. All that sort of music and Napalm Death and all this sort of thing. But there's a great documentary, and he said you could always hear the sound of the steam hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Dum, dum.
Yeah.
And that's that heavy metal thing, yeah. And Black Sabbath and all these bands. Led Zeppelin are from the Midlands. And I'm just fascinated that a bunch of guys, rather than go to work in the factory, thought, so I'm going to grow my hair long, wear eyeliner and a blouse. You know, it's great.
But you've kind of done that too. Like your dad worked in the car accessory factory. Was your mum an artist?
She was very, very creative and into the arts. She had a boarding school education. Although she, her dad, well, she was illegitimate and the father said he was an artist.
Right.
He was an artist in Sheffield.
So you definitely have a streak there.
Yeah, but he didn't really want, he educated her, but he didn't want to know her. So right. She didn't really have the benefits of a middle-class lifestyle, but she had the education.
Okay.
So she loved the theatre, she loved plays, she loved film, she loved jazz,
mm-hmm.
you know. So we were brought up, not really in a going to the theatre way or going to concerts, but very much it was part of our home life, you know, watching good films. And her love of jazz, really, you know, and she loves soul music as well. But, yeah, she was a very creative person, very individual and very, very unusual for a woman of her generation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So she was – there's a greater work ethic. They were both really good humanitarians, you know. So you got that mix of work ethic and creativity. So it was a nice – it was a good way to grow up. They were good people, you know.
Yeah.
They were good people.
Did you meet any resistance when you decided you were pissing off to London to go to art college?
Not from Mom. I mean, at the time, I didn't really know that her dad was an artist, or she probably told me, but being, at that age, you go, oh, it's my thing. And then she'd forget, he was an artist in Sheffield? No, didn't want to know. Now I'm really fascinated, but we don't know his name. So we're trying to find out. And at the time, she must have been thinking, well, what did you expect? But, sorry, what's the question? I've gone off again.
Did you meet any...
resistance, yeah, no. Not so much resistance, but my dad has you have choices, don't you? You can either do that, oh, my God, that's what's held me back. If only I'd had full support. Or you can see the humour in it.
Mm.
And I don't think... And I think that adds to your art and your character.
Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's true. Maybe I'd have got on quicker. But my dad, really, I felt guilty till I was about 27 for not being a nurse or a teacher or a wife. Or, he wasn't aggressive about it or nasty, but he wasn't that impressed because he was from a generation and a background. He was working at 12, 13 or something like that, where people like us didn't do that. So it was a little bit, who do you think you are, about the arts? That could be a number of reasons. It wasn't just that he had a narrow-minded attitude towards the arts. He genuinely believed that people should do something that was to do with public services. There's a bit of me like that. I think some people in the arts still don't quite get the value of public services sometimes, but that's another matter. I felt that during lockdown, but I don't know, that's a bit too complicated to discuss and I might be wrong. But, yeah, you could say it's resistance in that very occasion. You'd stop me and say, you do all your art, you think you work, and when you've got enough money, you don't want to work anymore. Yeah, you do all your arty stuff. But the arty was said as if, it was not the devil's work, they weren't religious, but it was definitely a frivolous pastime. Yeah. And I think maybe a bit of me agreed with him. Which is why it might have taken longer or something. I don't know. It's not true, really, because it's not seeing it as work. I see it very much as work, as most of us do. So, yeah, that would have held you back slightly because you want to please them. But then again, that's why I left home as well. I didn't want to. I wanted to develop in my own way and not.
I'm really interested in people's journey to accepting themselves as an artist.
Yeah.
And some people have parents who are artists, and so they owning that title feels natural.
Mm.
Some people like us, our parents are not artists, and the arrival of feeling okay with the word, feeling like it's not, a costume. It is actually my clothes. I can put this on and I feel comfortable. Yeah. This belongs to me. I am an artist.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting journey for people like us who haven't come from artistic families.
I think it really is. I am arrogant enough to think that makes me better than them. which is, it's a bit unfair now. That's rubbish. But, going through it, like, I suppose I got into jazz not just from my mother liking it, and my dad actually, I'm not saying he loved singers and good music, but I got it from clubbing, and going through the jazz funk route and then getting into, I've always liked all forms of music.
Mm.
I think what I would say what held me back was at school. I went to quite a good grammar school and they had a great music department. And I didn't do it there at all. I did art. And I definitely feel that the subculture and the music, the richness of the music that was already around Birmingham and my current, my little world, didn't quite match the sort of, I suppose what I thought was stuffiness of a classical education. But that would have been a certain amount of inverted snobbery on my part, that class thing where it's like, and I don't think that was right either. I definitely could have benefited from it. And I say that in my website is where that's why I came up against a wall with the saxophone, because I'd started too late and I didn't have enough grounding.
Mm.
Great sense of rhythm, great melody or nice sound. But that sort of... programming to practice and as by rote, just as muscle memory or whatever, wasn't ingrained, and that's why
I'd done dance, acting, saxophone, lots of jazz study. And that's why with singing, it all amalgamated.
Yeah.
And I felt I was doing something well.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should do stuff well, you know, and it's a craft.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too much into, but, you know, your journey and who you are secondary. It's a craft that's important, and then the rest informs it, you know.
100%. I get into this argument with students on the regular, particularly from a singing perspective, because I teach, I'm a vocal coach. And when I have students that don't want to make the sounds I'm asking them to make, and I have to say, stop a minute, I'm not telling you how to use your voice. Mm. I'm giving you a voice. I'm showing you the pathway, to build sounds so that you can have an aspirant sound and you can have a belt and you can have all of these different ways of using your voice so that then you're making artistic choices and it's not just default, this is how I sound, therefore everything is like that.
Mm.
I'm giving you a palette.
Or palette.
Yeah, I'm introducing you to red and yellow and not just blue. At the minute, you're just blue.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like sometimes we have to step outside of our comfort zone when we're learning an instrument or learning to sing, make sounds that we might not like as a bridge to somewhere else. But all of this is giving us a palette to work from, and we still might choose to only paint predominantly in blue. But at this point, it's a choice.
Well, you have to. I mean, I was sort of for example, Picasso, you know, he didn't start off in his blue period. He was a classical artist, you know, if anybody's been to Malaga or Barcelona, to any of the Picasso museums. And I remember going on an avant-garde weekend workshop years ago with my saxophone, and I was trying to say, but to me there's a difference in sound between somebody who is abstracting and somebody, there's nothing wrong with naive art, and somebody who hasn't learned to play the instrument. I can hear that difference. And it may be a political, you know, it gets politicised along the way, doesn't it? But I think there's a difference. I just think you've got to learn before you abstract.
Yeah, the difference is choice.
Yeah.
I feel the same about spiritual jazz. Most of it, I'm sorry to say, I feel like is nonsense. Sometimes I listen to it and it moves me so deeply, but it's usually because the person playing it has a deep knowledge of and facility within the music.
Yeah, I just think that, I mean, this whole thing about, it took me ages to think, you've got to earn some money, because I've always enjoyed the process of creative learning, whether it's dance or art or music or singing, or I've always, that process is enough for me. As long as I can pay my rent and bills. That's not a great, you know, I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't get paid for what they do for the arts, but it just took me quite a while, because the joy in learning and the spiritual, not religious spiritual, but the, I can't think of the word, you know, of just learning things is just fantastic. It creates brilliant people. But, you know, it creates a good society, doesn't it? And you know, the whole sort of everybody should be able to do this and it should be open to everybody. Well, it is, but you've still got to put the
work in.
Work in, you know. I mean, you could be from a privileged background, you know. I mean, you could be, you know, somebody's paid for you to go to the Royal Academy or whatever, but you can't buy 8 hours of practice a day.
Yeah.
You know,
100%.
It's all this sort of thing, you know. But it should be available to everybody, of course. But most of the work that we do is on our own, you know, and that's fine as well. And it's a bit similar to sports sometimes. But that's why, as well, with the saxophone, I was happy. People said, oh, you shouldn't be like that. And I'm like, well, I'm happy to be like that. I'm hearing what I can't play what I'm hearing. I'm talking about soloing and stuff, and I want to play what I like to hear.
Yeah
I'd be happy to be in a pop band and just play little bits and pieces, and you know, but I've been around jazz for 30 years and I grew up musically in the 606.
Mm-hmm. Can we speak about the 606?
Sorry, yeah, please do.
So how long have you been working there?
Oh, a long time. I hate saying it because some people aren't good with that and they think it's a failing. But I've been going there for the last 30 years and working for a good more than 20.
Why is that a failing?
I don't know. I think that's a very British thing as well. It's only of late that I think people, I don't know.
You clearly love the place. Well, you've given so much of your life.
Well, it's my rent and bills as well. I know it's like 3 or 4 nights a week. In one of the best jazz places in when I said Europe, and then somebody, another musician the other day, who was it, said the world. There was somebody I was talking to last night, a jazz musician. And
it's a special, special club.
Yeah, it's a really great club. Steve's amazing. And it just, I taught as well. I taught at Southampton Uni for a while and one-on-one, but I just prefer to do that. You know, it's as I said, it's my rent and bills, but it's also just an amazing place to work and to have been educated in, because everybody good comes through it, whether it's soul, whether it's jazz, soul, funk, whatever type of music, you know, because it's not just a jazz club, it's a music club. And you know, when you get soul singers, at soul people there, or soul bands, they've played with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They're top session musicians.
Mm.
You just hear every night at work there, people go, this is amazing. There's a young girl who's just started working there, and Miss Wayne Hernandez's gig, and she said, this is one of the best nights of my life.
Yeah.
She's 13, she's just started working there. And it's just an education. You know, everything I've done really since coming to London to do with music and jazz has been an education, but this is like a major part of it. And you know yourself, you know, you've worked there it's just an extraordinary place. It's an extraordinary place and an extraordinary world, and it's part of the jazz world, which as a community is great. You know, it is a strong community. I mean, I won't go into too much detail, but, you know, he will support musicians.
Yeah, I have so much time for Steve because, as we were talking about before, Steve was the first person to give me a shot in a jazz club as a harpist.
Yeah.
And nobody could hear what I was doing because they could just see the harp and it didn't belong in their world.
Yeah.
Whereas Steve said, yeah, come down. And he's been inviting me back ever since.
Yeah.
And he gave me the shot. He opened the door for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's a really special man.
No, he is. He's really brilliant. And they're all great, you know, all these people. And Paul Pace. I mean, when I first started singing, when I decided, right, I would take a different song every week to the Spice of Life,
mm-hmm.
and you know, got these charts made. Yeah, because it used to be a gig and then an open mic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about in the 90s, really. I think they're like, excuse me, we'd have a good all night, we'd do that. And then I got a gig, I took my cassette tape into Café Bohème, and they said, do you want to do a gig tomorrow? And I was like, yeah. And I ran over to Paul at the Spice and said, can you lend me a mic or an amp or something? I can't remember, but I hadn't got any equipment, so I wasn't expecting to get it that quick. And so we'd do an afternoon gig, and then we'd go to the Spice, and then we'd go to Ronnie's.
Oh, fabulous.
With a meal at Polo, which has just been closed down, apparently, because of cockroaches or something. But that was like a regular Soho thing.
Yeah.
Rachel Calladine, me, Ramsey McGuinness, who's Aussie. One of the first, well, John China actually was the first person I used to work with, and that's another story. But when I got those gigs, I ran to Ronnie's because I thought, I need somebody to play with tomorrow.
Yeah.
It was tomorrow afternoon, and it was like nighttime. And Ramsey was there. I said, do you want to do a gig tomorrow? He was like, yeah. And he was guitarist, Ramsey McGuinness, from us. I can't remember whether he's from Sydney or what, but he's been back for quite a while. But he was in London ages,
mm-hmm.
and we did loads of duo stuff and recording and that, and because, you know, there's always been loads of Aussie musicians.
Yeah.
Like Mark Johns, you know, great people.
Anita Wardell, Trudy Kerr.
Oh, yeah, Anita. Yeah, I was talking about music, but, yeah, of course. And Victoria Newton, do you remember her?
No.
She's great. Naomi Ayres, who used to sing at the club. Oh, yeah, always, always good people.
So returning back to my Birmingham,
Yes. And we meandered. I do meander.
Yeah, but
you know,
it's a joyful wandering down the garden path.
Yeah.
Speeding along, the National Express meets the tangle of the Spaghetti Junction across the River Tame, connecting me to London, Birmingham to London, London to Birmingham, connecting me to my Birmingham. Past the Aston Reservoir, the cement tomb of the Salford cycle track, and then looming into view and dominating the grey, brown, blue, Fort Dunlop, gatekeeper of our second city. Past the long, low engine sheds. What are they for, Dad? It's where they make string. And I believed him for years. Queensway, Ringway, Underpass and Subway. All Point Rotundaway. Memories of walkway through the dark belly of the Midland Red bus station. Dodging pools of diesel and squash chips and up the escalator to the Bullring Shopping Centre. An air-conditioned crypt of broken light bulbs. Hanging neon shop signs, dead and dulled by the 90s. No longer a template, but stark, drab and dingy. Serving only to typify a decaying city.
The sandstone city ridge declines steeply into Digbeth and its lurkish coach station, waiting in all of its dark brick, dank and smelly glory for me to come home. It's what you knew and know rather than the new that makes you love. On to the suburbs, Handsworth to the north, walking along just to kick King's stones to the south, my side of town, Bartbrook, Moseley, Borsall Heath, the Irish, the Jamaican, joining the workforce and bringing the crack and the reggae beat on the threshold of a dream of a promised land. People of all nations walking hand in hand down the Ladypool Road, once with a pub on every corner, to refuel those that work to rebuild a Birmingham that town planners constantly pull down. Four bunches of pounds.
So this is a special track because it features spoken word.
Yeah.
And you wrote the poems.
Yeah, I did. Well, not, a couple of them were what my mum wrote. She wasn't a prolific poet, or, you know, but she did write poems. I was looking for one that she'd written about cycling, and my brother's got it in a scrapbook somewhere, and of course he lost it. There used to be a little cycling leaflet called A Wheel.
Right.
My brother was a cyclist. He's now an events organiser and that. But we grew up with cycling in the family, which was incredibly exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go off and travel the world, and we'd wait up for him, and he'd bring little presents, and it was sweet. But, you know, we grew up going to see cycling at velodromes. There were velodromes all over England, Leicester, Nottingham. Leicester was a big one, not Derby, and Salford, which is... the very beginning of the spoken word Birmingham bit. And originally I thought I wanted to do some of her poems, and I wanted to do one about cycling because there was a guy called Didier Misidaro who used to work at the Six,
mm-hmm,
in the 90s, and he played sax as well. He wasn't so much of a jazzer, but he made music, and then he went to live in Brighton. And he also is a painter and an artist. In fact, I chose one of his pieces for my last EP, Safe Places. And I listened to his music and I thought, I really like this music. It's great. It's filmic. He does it for film and TV. And of course it's filmic. It's very linear and it's not AABA. And so along with the poetry, and I do like avant-garde, stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that Maggie Nichols, I did classes with her when I was first. I do quite like a bit of actor. You know, all that sort of
like
thing.
Like Phil Minton.
Yeah, yeah. I love all that. Because, you know, I mean, that's going back to what we were saying. There are Phil Minton, there are big, I don't even know the type of music because I'm a bit thick about certain things, but he's a choral singer, isn't he?
Yeah, I had a chat to him, which I moronically forgot to record.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Right back at the start of the jazz podcast days.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I was so embarrassed. And I did approach Phil to say, I'm very sorry, I'm an idiot and I forgot to record it. Perhaps we could do it again. And he sent me a response, which was a recording of him making sounds, and the recording was called Lament. So I took that to mean he wasn't up for doing it again.
Yeah. Oh, no. Because of Westbrook's and everything. Actually, during lockdown, they did some, they were putting on a series of videos and things that they'd done. I work with, when we're down in the West Country, Graham York is drummer. He works mm-hmm. with them. But, yeah, you know, he's a classically trained singer.
Yeah.
But it all gets abstracted. And so I've always been interested in that. I used to be in a 20-saxophone all-female avant-garde group run by Caroline Carabel, who's really big on the... I mean, for me, it was... I have to put my hands up here and say... Some of that is because I'm not great, so I quite like Binky Bonk Bonk Bonk. But, you know, technically.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you
yeah.
So, you know, that is a bit not... But the, as I said, you know, it's not that I didn't put time in. It's literally the babadillium, but no, I want the dexterity and stuff. It's just not in me to do it.
But it's so lovely to hear your Birmingham accent right in the forefront at the beginning of the record.
Yes.
My Birmingham, there she is.
Yeah.
Speaking about this city that you love.
Well, I'd been going back quite a lot when lockdown opened, and I'd been going back in a different way thinking. First, I was trying to find all the places that we used to go to, which seemed like for years and years and years, but as soon as I left at 18, and we did stop going to pubs quite early, made us go, bloody hell, we were 14. There's only a few years of going out, really, and a lot of the places had gone. Let's go back to those poems, because what I was trying to look for was the one about cycling that my mum had written. And at the very top of that, my Birmingham thing, a part of it goes past the Aston Reservoir and the cement tomb of the Salford cycle track, because mm-hmm. it's been tarmacked over, like right. a lot of velodromes. They've been changed into warehouses or stuff yeah. like that. It's a real shame because cycling's big again. And I do like track cycling. I love watching track cycling. And so that's the only way I could bring it in, really. And I kept asking him, I said, I want you to do a little recording for me. Some of it talking about your journey, you know, he got into cycling because he'd got something wrong with his legs. It's called something when he was young, and they recommended cycling to build him up, you know. And I said, in another one, I want to know what it's like on the bike when you're, you know, in that moment of, you know. And because I'd got two tracks of Didier's and I thought they really fitted, and I wanted to celebrate that side of me because it was so much part of my upbringing, cycling, and mm-hmm. with this poem on my mom's. Yeah, so it was a number of things in that. It was about the music from Birmingham. It was about, well... you know, the Bullring Market in particular, because what I'd done during lockdown, I'd started watching these funny old videos about Birmingham. I just got completely nostalgic for it. And I've got a slight fascination with Grimm. I like concrete and urban and squash chips and
so you love the Guildhall and all the brutalist architecture.
Yeah, I love brutalist architecture. I mean, I did a couple of journeys and I got on buses, but I did out-Grimm myself. I thought I'd done it. You know, I was sitting on the edge of a council estate with a laundry and having a coffee. Luckily, it was an Eritrean restaurant, so it was good coffee. But I thought, I think I've out-Grimmed myself now, you know. But there's something about that 1980s. It was Grimm. The 1980s was Grimm. There's a little clip from in that video of a kid wandering around, and it's from a YouTube link about the Bullring shopping centre in the 80s, and everything was grey or pale blue or washed out, and you just get that sense of grimness before really the turn of the century when it all started to come up again, and you know, but the 80s was pretty grim. Tower blocks, you know.
Yeah.
Laundrettes. It's but I have a sort of nostalgia for it. I suppose, as I say in that, it's what you knew and know.
Yeah.
That, you know. For some people it's beautiful landscapes. But
that's it. When I listen to your record.
Down, you know.
Totally. I listen to your record and I get a lot of love from it.
Yeah, and it's that real. I like the gritty Birminghamness of it, and I don't know, greyness or a landscape of chimneys and rooftops and things like that.
It's very Mary Poppins,
and it's very much to do. Well, it is, but it's also to do with you, what you really love, of things that mean something to you. So I'm it's my associations with all those things. So with the Spaghetti Junction and stuff like that, every time I come on a coach, coaches are always the National Express thing as well, and Digbeth Coach Station are my link to London and Birmingham, because mm-hmm. I'd been coming to London twice a year from Birmingham from a kid, from when I was born, because my mother's best mate mm-hmm. and her daughter being my age. So I was always going to and fro London, you know, mm-hmm. and so it's all little things like that. And passing the Salford cycle, every time I'd come over, I think there's the cycle track.
Yeah.
You know, there's the cycle track. So it's all parts of your childhood, you know, really.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Because it really is a tour guide of love.
Yeah, thank you. That's a nice way to put it.
And you have, you know, obviously a lovely expressive voice. The arrangements are beautiful. You're playing with incredible musicians. It's a really beautiful record.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like it. And then with the other stuff, there was a mother's poetry. The one about my dad, because I was listening to what had happened as well along the way, is some of the tracks I liked of Didier has inspired different things. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to write something. I mean, it's 20 years ago since he died now. And what I was fascinated by, and it's all keeping in line with this industrial Birmingham, I wanted it all to fit in and have a theme throughout. Mm. When he was passing away, we were lucky to not in the Curie Hospital. We had a little room. There was all these little rooms for guys with kidney complaints, really, of different ages, and that's roughly what he died of, you know. And but he was an older man, you know. And we had a bed for us, for a member of the family, which was lovely. And one by one, everybody got very busy, and my brother was on one of the cycling tours that he used to take Dad on. And I said, look, I've got until so-and-so, so I'll stay with him, you know. And when you see, it's a very similar process with people in that palliative care and in their last, you know, the body, you see the body breaking down and you think, oh God, it's a bit like it's just a piece of machinery, isn't it? You know, mm-hmm. one thing breaks down and then, and it's a familiar pattern, because I sort of read a bit about it as well afterwards and listened to other people. And so that all kind of went in line with the whole industrial nature of Birmingham, and the fact that he was a maintenance fitter. And I thought, I want to pay tribute to him, but I don't want it to be too tragic or over sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watching his dying breath. I thought, I want to make it a little bit. To liken it to something like that makes it not over, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to over emote.
Yeah.
And it just seemed more poignant. And with spoken word, if it had been sung, it would have been a bit sort of over emotive. But with spoken word and that whole, you know, we wanted the sort of sound of, like, you know, you get those buzzes and noises in hospitals and things. Mm-hmm. But it just seemed to be able to, I could pay tribute to him. And the family, you know, would understand it without milking it and being over emotive.
Yeah.
It
really comes across.
Personal stories as well, you know, it was just time to do that. As I said, I've been very candid about that, but there seems to be a time to do it, and you've got your little folder with mm-hmm. your letters and your special things.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's nice to celebrate them, you know.
Yeah, but you've done it in a way, I guess, you've turned the tap just enough to give us an insight into who you are. You haven't put it on full bore and let the faucet just gush out.
Yeah.
Which is too much as an audience member. Yeah. You're a little bit uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, that's it. It's that fine line with art, isn't it? That you want to tell your story. As I said, it's taken me long enough, you know. Because I think, as my dad used to say, there's such a thing as a private life, you know. But that is the thing with art, and you put that very well, in that you want people to empathise, but you don't want to be, you don't want to do victim or tragedy or...
No,
because it's, that's...
Well, that's not art, that's what is good it? Art.
Yeah, yeah, when it's... Yeah,
it comes back to the thing of craft that you were saying.
Craft and taste.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, of course, we can get that sort of snobbery accusation, but there's got to be some way of not testing it. What's the word I'm looking
for? Funneling it.
Huh?
Funneling.
Well, no, as in not testing, grading. Oh, that's the wrong word. You know, one can start sort of analysing, well, what makes good art good and what... But there's got to be some... What's the word I'm looking for? Not test. Something like that. Yardstick. So, you know, that sort of thing. And it's like films, isn't it? You know, a great... I mean, what's that film? The Sporting Life. Stella Adler, was it? It was based on some of that... Some of the Swedish plays or Nordic plays, but there's a moment where the main female character, her husband was a miner and he died in a mining accident, and every day she has a ritual of polishing his boots by the hearth, and Richard Harris is just leaning on the doorway watching at the back of her head while she polishes, and it's so moving.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if she'd been like, I polish these boots to remind me of my husband, you know.
Yeah, it's too much.
I mean, the comic strip did a really great skit on what, if they'd have Hollywooded up things like the miners' strike, or you know, 60s social realism was a great British era of filmmaking, Whistle Down the Wind, The Family Way, and it was very sort of kitchen sink drama, it was called. And just that sort of thing of being... you know, it's much more emotional. I suppose it's less is more, you know, rather than going.
But I love that about the British culture and about, well, British art, British television and literature, you know, where we have a subtlety and it means, you know, over time as we consume it, as we're brought up consuming it, we have a finer, I don't know, what's the word?
Understated?
Our scale, our scale is finer. You know, we're able to digest and notice detail, and it's a lovely thing.
Yeah, I was trying to think of an analogy where I can't remember. Anyway, it's a similar thing. I remember when my dad did die. It's very typical. Sometimes I'd nodded off to sleep and. And when I woke up, the nurse who was Brummy at the end of the bench, he's gone, love. And it was just so, you know, so sweet. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking of an analogy that I used to use, you know, if it was Hollywooded up, it would be like, your father has passed away, you know, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But just that sort of simpleness of good theatre and film, really.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing, not over-egging the pudding, as they say, or something like that. But that's what one aims for.
Well, I think you've definitely nailed it.
That's probably why we haven't got any money, though.
No, you've really nailed it. It's a beautiful record. So, everybody, please check out Esther Bennett, Home is Where the Art Is.
Yes.
And thank you very much for this tangential conversation.
Can I just say that the title as well, there's a Brummy thing there. The rest, it was just going to be an EP of spoken word, but we sort of thought, let's make a little album. It's not a major big album, really, you know. And I just put in favourite standards and ideas, you know, and really, you know, songs that were close to my heart. But Home is Where the Art Is has got two meanings, really. Clearly, this album is about... home and nostalgia and things, but also if you say home is where the heart is in the Birmingham accent, it's home is where the art is.
So it is
that as well.
Home is where the art is.
Yeah.
Esther Bennett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jazz Podcast. We'll see you next week.